What's going on, everybody? This is Black Men Sundays. I'm your host, Corey Sylvester Murray, and we're talking about generational wealth, finance, business. It's a Black Man Sunday. Time to put all childish things away. I refuse to be the man I was yesterday. Gotta put my best foot forward and elevate. And today, we're speaking with Richard McWhorter. This brother is a managing partner and private wealth advisor at SRM Private Wealth. He's based in Beverly Hills, California. He's managed $1.8 billion in assets for high-profile clients, athletes, and entertainers. And he was on the 2020 Forbes Best in State Wealth Advisors list. So he's guided clients through retirement, through estate planning, through philanthropic giving. So without further ado, Richard McWhorter, welcome to Black Men Sundays, man. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Thanks for having me on today.
Definitely. So let's just jump right into it. You work with athletes, entertainers. So why do so many high income earners struggle building lasting wealth?
If I had one thing to choose, it would be spending habits. I think spending is the biggest part of going through wealth or not building wealth. For a lot of the people that we've come across.
So what should someone prioritize first when the big bucks start rolling in?
When we start with anybody that gets a contract or a new album comes out or a new deal, whatever that looks like, the first thing that we want to do is we want to look at what we're going to end up with after taxes, after, you know, in the entertainment world and music and athletics, it's, you know, I've got representation. So I have agents, managers, business managers, lawyers. So when I'm looking at that, I want to look at what the net is after I take care of my representation, how much I pay in taxes, and this is what I end up with. And looking at that net number and then what that's going to look like as far as spending is concerned, how do we put money away for the future? There's a lot that goes into it at that point. Because you got to remember, a lot of these guys, it's a short term, or girls. We only deal with males so far, but there's a lot to, you know, having this money last for a long period of time, and how long someone's career is going to be is unknown. How big the contracts are unknown. So there's so many different things to planning for the future that way.
And you mentioned short term success. So how do you help clients turn short-term success into long-term generational wealth? Because that's really what our show's all about.
It's the generational wealth concept is very interesting. It's, you know, looking at, listen, I think the first thing I need to do is I need to make sure that the person is taken care of for their lifetime. And then the looking at generational wealth is being able to look at it outside of that. You know, we've dealt with some people that, you know, want to leave everything to their children and the next generation. And then we have other people that are thinking about just spending every single dime until it's gone during their lifetime. And they've given their kids every opportunity to build it on their own. So that generational wealth concept is really interesting. But I need to take care of the people today and make sure that they've got enough money to live the rest of their lives. And you know, whether it's if it's a short career, if it's a longer career, how big of monies are we talking about during that period of time? And then what does that look like for, you know, when we're running future value numbers for years to come? And that's kind of what we do. We start looking at 20, 25, 30 years, and we can estimate a bunch of different things like inflation and spending habits and then what does that look like going forward to see if we're going to be able to take care of not only the person making the money, but then actually be able to pass that on for generational.
That's very interesting. And you mentioned estate planning. So when is a good time, or when is it, or is it too early to establish or set up estate planning?
The estate planning in general is just having your voice in what happens with the monies if something, God forbid, should happen to you. So estate planning by itself, I don't think that's any early part to it. Not being too early, I would rather have my money go to the people that I want my money to go to, rather than some type of lawyer or state or whatever, however the, you know, whatever process of the probate process you would go through otherwise, or to have people that are in my family that are making claims to something that they believe that they deserve. So, doing estate planning of any sort, having a trust and a will, is just my voice. And then, if something happened to me and I'm incapacitated, and able to make decisions for myself, who's going to make those decisions? And that's the basic estate planning that we would recommend at any point.
Gotcha. Yeah. Thanks for clarifying that, because we've talked about estate planning on the show. And that's always been the question is, okay, when is it too early? When should we? So thanks for clearing that up. So Richard, what are three financial moves every man, especially every Black man, should take seriously and consider making in the next 12 months?
Yeah, listen, I think anybody that is trying to build wealth, the first and foremost is to understand where I'm spending my money. How much am I making and how much am I spending? If I can understand and look at what I'm spending as the difference between wants and needs, that's a big deal. We have a lot of needs. I need a cup of coffee, so I got to go to Starbucks. I don't need a cup of coffee from Starbucks for $7. I can make it at home for $1. So there's, the want is different than the need. And I do think that starting off with spending by far is key. Second to that is that if you start to build or save money, how do we want to save money? Do we want to use it through potential 401ks that you have available? Are you putting money into a Roth IRA or a conventional IRA? Are you doing it in after-tax money and you're starting to build a portfolio that way? And then lastly is, how do I invest that money? And that's where either you're going to do it on your own, or you're going to hire a financial advisor to do that for you.
And I know you touched on this because you said it's spending, but the question that I want to ask is, what's the biggest mistake you see successful Black professionals make once the big bucks start rolling in, outside of like the spending? Because we all know that.
That's the biggest thing for me. Second biggest thing is just, if I had to look at one thing, it would be looking at investments that are being shown to me and not putting the right team around them to discern whether that's a good investment or not. So making bad investments would be the second thing that I see more than anything. And understanding the risk for I get hit up on all the time for various deals that come across either a client's desk or their management's desk or whatever it may be. And, I have to give my opinion on that and whether I think it's viable or not. But I do think that bad investments is probably the second biggest mistake that is made by anybody that really destroys because once you lose that money, it's a big deal. In financial advisement, there's an old saying that says that if you have a dollar and it goes to 50 cents, you've lost 50%. But to go from 50 cents back to a dollar, you have to make 100% on your money. So when you look at it in that respect, taking that risk on the downside, you really have to understand, am I okay with losing everything that I've invested in this? You may be really hyped on it, you may be all that, but there's so many things that could go wrong, and you have to be okay with that idea.
Richard McWhorter, are you enjoying yourself on Black Men Sunday so far?
Yeah, I love talking about this stuff, and the questions are great, so I appreciate it.
Nice, I love it. Like I said, you're the managing partner and private wealth advisor at SRM Private Wealth. So let's talk about the company, how you got involved with that.
37 years ago, I was an intern at old company called Dean Winter Reynolds, which was a big firm back then, and got the internship there, and then worked as a receptionist and an intern, and then in 92 got my break to become a financial advisor, and it's been since 92, so what is that, 33 years ago, going in my 34th year. And we were at Smith Barney for about 16 years, Merrill Lynch for about 16 years, and then went off on our own about 16 months ago now. you know, we've been very fortunate over the years. I've been very grateful about, you know, the type of clients that we've come across and the situations we've been put into by them and what they include us in. You know, we get included in a lot of different ways in which to give our voice to situations that arise for them. And they bring me in because they respect the opinion. So that's kind of what makes my job so fruitful, and I'm very grateful for that. So yeah, that's kind of the practice. We've got 36 families. We run at this point, I know it said 1.8 billion, but we're probably around closer to 2.1 billion at the moment. It's been a ride, and I enjoy it. So
gotcha. I love that. And I want you to clarify something else. So when people say high net income earners, because I've heard some people say, "Oh, I make 80,000, I'm high income." I'm like, I don't think so. So from a professional perspective, what qualifies one to say that they're a high income or high net earner?
Perspective. You know, the person that just you mentioned that said they've got $80,000. To them, that's high earner, right? So if, you know, we're not discerning based upon the idea that someone's a high earner or high net worth or ultra high net worth. To be honest, I don't even know what those definitions, where those definitions are at. You know, we have people of various generations or that have built wealth over time with us. And, you know, so it's not, we don't start off just saying, hey, we're just going to deal with people of a certain net worth or a certain income or whatever it may be. You know, what's funny about financial advisement is that, like, I have a client that has nine figures and they spend $1 million a month on stuff. Theoretically, they're going to be bankrupt at some point if they don't stop. And I've discussed this with them. And second to that is I have people with 250, 300, 400,000, and they live perfectly fine for their standard of living and they're happy. So the question is what's the difference between those two? One's not going to go bankrupt and the other one's going to go bankrupt, even though the other one has a tremendous amount of money. They could stop, by the way. Those people with nine figures can stop spending so much money, which I try to get them to do, but they don't want to. So I have a hard time with all those definitions that we use for high net worth, ultra high net worth, high earners. It's all relative to what it is to you. And that's how I truly look at it.
Got you. Great information. So, fellas, the stage is open. Say your name, your city, and your state, and you're on Black Men Sundays.
Hey, sir. This is Kalali Dogbe. I'm from Prince Frederick, Maryland. Hey. Definitely appreciate you spending time with us. Have enjoyed the comments so far. I'm going to ask you one question. It's going to be kind of a long question, and it might be an odd question the way I'm answering it, particularly just because it's something that my mind is on. And I don't even know if it necessarily relates to financial advisement in any way that's like, you know, any way that's relevant. But so my question, though, is about like risk tolerance. So what I've been paying attention lately to is a couple of things is like what they've called, and you may know what I'm talking about, what they're calling the gamifying of financial services in terms of investment. So we got a lot of different types of investments that's going on right now. We got traditional investment, and we have a lot of people who are investing in things like crypto. And then kind of parallel to that, it's very easy for people to gamble on their phones now because you've got all the apps that let you gamble. You know, we've got the different companies that do gambling and things like that. And then behind that, what we've seen lately is like the rise of like prediction markets where you can like basically bet on any future event to happen. And so I'm wondering, are you seeing the impacts of these things in your client base? What advice do you try to give people in terms of doing that? And how do you judge risk tolerance? Is that something that's based on, is that something, I'm talking about the advice you give, is that something that's based on a person's income, you know, how much risk tolerance they might have? Is that more about their attitude? Is that more about, you know, other factors that maybe I'm not thinking about?
No, it's a great question, by the way. And I love it all. Okay, so on a personal level, the Kalshis, the Poly Markets, the crypto industry, all the stuff that's going on, DraftKings, whatever platform you want to look at. I think, you know, we used to have to go to Las Vegas to do this stuff, and now it's on our phones and it's much more readily available, which is good and bad. It depends on, you know, it's like any other addiction, right? It's I like to make a bet every once in a while on Kalshi, and I make a bet every once in a while on a football game, the Super Bowl I got my bets in. So, you know, as far as clients are concerned, it really doesn't come up. And a lot of the clients that we have are, you know, they do their little betting or they play poker or whatever it may be on either online or in person. And, you know, all that stuff, I think, is just minor, unless it's not, right? And unless we allow it to consume a lot of our disposable income. And that becomes a bigger issue, right? So now you're betting either your spending or you're betting actually your savings on something that normally we have no control over. So when you're betting like that, we don't know what's going to happen. You know, I'll bet with my kids on a UFC fight, let's say. And from my perspective, UFC fight's 50-50. One hit and I'm down, and I don't care if you're the favorite or not. So right. You really have to understand that the type of betting, the risk level of that betting is really big. And you might think you know, but we don't know. That's the truth, right? One injury today and it could change the entire game. Yeah. So, and that affects the Kalshis and the poly markets and the DraftKings and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. You get into crypto. If you know, I love the idea behind crypto, and I love the deregulated, decentralized currency concept. The reality is, I don't even know, and I've been doing a lot of study on this for years. You know, Bitcoin makes no sense to me on a personal level, but on an investment level, it's done very well. So, if you look at Ethereum and Solana and these other ones, it's a whole different being, right? Where they have a business, behind Ethereum, there's a business aspect to it. You know, and there's a smart contract, right? So all those things are, you have to understand, once again, to the best of your ability, the risks that you're taking with any of this stuff. And these risk levels are far greater, in my opinion, than most of the traditional stocks that you would look at. As far as risk level, and we can come back and see if I make sure I answered everything, but as far as risk level makes, when an advisor asks a client their risk level, it makes zero sense to me. I know I have to for regulation purposes, but the reality is risk is I want to make as much money and take as little risk as I possibly can. So, and then if things are going well, everyone wants more risk. If everything's going bad, I wanted less risk, right? So risk is a conceptual idea of this is, as I said, I want to make as much money as I possibly can for as little risk as I possibly can. And you know, the reality behind all this stuff is that my job with a lot of clients is to understand what I think their risk level is. I have to make those determinations because of past conversations, because of times that they panic sold or wanted to panic sell and I had to hold them out of it. There's a lot of situations that have arisen over the last number of years, the last, you know, in some cases 30 years, where, you know, you get to know that person's risk level over time. But to ask somebody what their risk level is, it's just so funny to me. You know, I'll leave you with this, is that I like to play poker. And so I'm playing poker and I look at a hand and I've got, you know, let's say I can calculate the odds and I go, okay, well, I've got an 80% chance of winning this hand. Well, what that really means to me is I have an 8%, 8 out of 10 times I'm going to win and 2 out of 10 times I'm going to lose. That's the reality. And so I have to understand that about that 0.2%, that 2%, 20% chance, if I can say this correctly, 20% chance that I'm going to lose that hand. And if you don't understand that with any of these things that you're doing and understand that downside, you're taking on too much risk by definition, because you're not understanding what the risk is. So spend some time understanding the downsides to things. If the upside happens, and it's awesome, right? But if you're still good with it and you've taken into consideration that downside, that's a bigger deal for me.
No, that's an excellent answer. That was the question I had for you for today. I appreciate you taking the time to answer. You gave a really thorough answer. I like the response and really taking the time to understand what the risk of loss is on your side. If you can bear that risk of loss, then you know, do what you do.
Do what you do. That's exactly right. And a lot of people only look at the upside. Listen, man, I hear stories every day, all day. You know, these business owners come to me and they're like, hey, do you have any clients that might be interested in investing in things? And then I look at the stuff and I'm like, yeah, no, there's too much risk involved for most of the people that I deal with. But they have wonderful stories behind them. You know what I mean? So that's how I see that stuff. And you know what? The last thing I'll say on that is, those are real life. That's real life. That question that you just asked comes up and needs to be thought about and needs to be discussed. Because I do hear those types of questions, not in that format, right? Not that thoroughly, but these types of things do come up when we're having conversations with people.
So sure. I want to talk about the wealth preservation. So basically a client has a traditional IRA, they have the 401k, they may have went to a different company and transferred their pensions and annuities to the new company. Well, not the new company, but to their financial advisor. That way you can kind of, duck that 20%. But what challenges, do you see clients facing now that you have such wealth accumulating? Like I said, especially if you have something in a traditional in you're seeing like high amounts growing daily. How do you navigate the client relationship with you so they don't say, oh, I want to touch that?
Yeah, you go through the effects of it, right? So when we are talking to clients and we're going through it, we're showing them, I mentioned before, we're showing future value numbers, right? So here's what we have today. Here's different interest rates of return on an after-tax basis. They're estimates. You know, here's what your Social Security looks like. If you start to spend money, if you start to take that money away, then we have to revamp those numbers because now I don't have that money to invest, which means that money is not going to be making any money for you and will not be available at a future date. So if let's say you want to go buy a second home or a car or whatever it may be, you know, all right, well, we're going to take $50,000 out for a car. And what does that mean to me, right? What is that going to do to my overall over a period of time? And am I cool with that? And that's where it becomes a bigger deal, right? So you just need to understand what the impact is going to be for the future. It's clients' money at the end of the day, and I can give them my opinion all day long, but they're going to make the ultimate decision on that. So I need to show them what the impact is going to be to the plan that we put together when they do spend some of that money prior to when we had it planned.
Yeah, because so many times on this show we talk about building the wealth, but when we talk about the preservation of it, I feel like that's where the challenges come in. Because I see so many people, well, I've been building wealth for 30 years from that accumulation phase, but then once they get to the preservation phase, it's like, well, I don't want to run out, but I still want to maintain the level of lifestyle that I'm living. So see, that's why I always say a financial advisor is very important. So
yeah, it could be, if you can be on top of all of this stuff that's going on in the markets and, politically and socially and all these impacts to the economy in general, if you can keep on top of that and you think that you're good at it, then financial advisors may be not necessary for you. You know, we get hired by a lot of people that don't have the bandwidth to be able to do it on their own. They want someone out there that's making these decisions and researching and reading and doing all these different types of things to navigate all this stuff that's going on. But some people enjoy doing that on their own and they don't need someone like me. Just know that whatever, as you're doing this, you have to decide on that wealth preservation. You have to decide on what that looks like for you. And goes back to your question that you asked me earlier, which was in regards to generational wealth. Do you want this to go to the next generations? Is that important? A lot of people I've met have said yes, and a lot of people I've met have said no. So that's always an interesting question, and always it's more interesting the answer and why.
Great information. And my last question for you, I want to talk about philanthropic giving and how can a financial advisor integrate brand building with philanthropy in their wealth strategy without compromising any type of stability?
A lot of people are very philanthropic and others are not, right? And so that's a conversation that we have with people, and whether or not they want to be, and then at what level, and do they have the ability to do it at the level that they want to do it at? And if not, then we have to figure out what that level is. So a lot of it is just another part of the spending part of that conversation, is how much do I want to give away? And you know, sometimes it's for tax reasons, sometimes it's for very philanthropic, and it's all of those things have to come into the conversations that financial advisors have with their clients. And then how do we fit it in or not, depending on what their wants are. I know some people that are very philanthropic, and I also know some people that are very not philanthropic. And if they're philanthropic, then that's something that we have to work with. And then how do we give money, right? We work on that. We work with the charities on, you know, here's the projects that we would be interested in funding and why. And there is a lot of work to that part of it, but it really does come down to, you know, these clients are going to dictate what they're interested in, how they're interested, at what level they're interested. And then we try and help them make that happen.
If someone were looking to hire you as a financial advisor, let's say they do a traditional traditional IRA, based on the client, would you recommend that they do more of a conservative plan or more of an aggressive wealth building strategy based on the climate? And I know it's, you know, different per individual. I'm just saying, generally speaking, if you had someone that, let's say, had $300,000 in a traditional setting it up, would you
recommend give me an idea of how old this person is? Give me an idea of that.
Person 60.
60. Yeah. So you're going to want to be a little bit more conservative, right? The question on how conservative is more of a conversation to have with the client. But you're going to want to be more conservative at that point. You know, I don't know, you know, there would be a lot of talk in regards to what this needs to produce for you over a period of time. Are we willing to take money risk in the stock market, either with individual stocks, ETFs? We really don't recommend mutual funds, but if you're going to do those types of things in the equity markets, do we want it to produce an income for you? And we want to make sure that everything is pretty stable and you don't have to think much about it. So a lot of these things are really having these in-depth conversations about what that client wants and what that client's willing to do, at least up front. There could be, you know, changes that take place over time as we dial in the risk level that person is willing to take on. And then the other thing is that, you know, 2026 is an interesting year, and 2025 and the past number of years have been very interesting. And it just seems to get more and more interesting every year. I would say to you that if someone came to you 60 years old, I'm going to start off at a not necessarily conservative level, but definitely moderately conservative at a starting point. But as I said, it will take a bunch of conversations to occur.
But let's ask that question again. And a person's 46 years old with that same $300,000, would you
more aggressive? Do it? Yeah. The younger you are, the more cycles you have, the business cycles you have to go through theoretically. And so, you know, the one thing is that if we're starting from this point today and we're looking at the future, right? What does that look like? Right? If you can tell me what the stock market's going to do next week, we can make a lot of money. We can go on Kalshi and bet that right now. So, but my point is that there is no, I do this every single day, and I read about this stuff every single day, and I have no idea what it's going to do next week. I don't know what's going to look like a year from now or 5 years from now. And by the way, nobody does. So at the end of the day, you have to have a starting point to it. And then you have to be able to be nimble through this. And with all the stuff that's going on and all the changes that are occurring, I don't care whether you agree with it or not, that's a whole nother situation. But in general, you have to be nimble enough to go through these things. And so it's ever changing. You're always trying to evolve with whatever, or devolve, depending on how you look at it, with everything that's going on. So yeah, I think it's very important to be open and I'll use the word again, nimble.
All right. Well, there we have it. Richard McWhorter, I appreciate you. I appreciate your time coming on Black Men Sundays. Definitely enjoyed this conversation. So enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you, Corey. I appreciate it. And you too. It's a Black Man Sunday. Time to put all child
first things over.